A big show for everyone right now. Tom House is with us today on Bottom Line Baseball, and he's with Jackson in San Diego right now. So, guys, how are we doing today?
Real good. 72 and sunshine. We just got off the field in a baseball camp. Life doesn't get any better than this.
Yeah, it's been great to have this camp. We have it every probably 8 to 12 weeks, and it's been really good to be out here.
I'm jealous of you guys.
So
It's
with
actually about 60 degrees and a little chilly here today. So you guys have us beat in Texas with the weather.
I honestly don't feel bad for you at all.
Well, getting into this, Tom, we're going to talk a little bit about mustard and a
Okay.
little later on, but growing up, what made you decide you wanted to play baseball?
I look back and I can honestly not remember when I didn't want to play baseball. I played all sports and I was a good little athlete, but not great in anything. But I threw a curveball like from day one. And we know now that a left-handed pitcher that can throw a curveball for a strike usually hangs around for a while. So that was probably the key to me getting people out in high school, college, and even professional baseball.
So when did you know? Because I know you just said that you never really had a moment that you knew you didn't want to play baseball. Did you ever have that moment after your career saying, okay, I want to stay in the game? When did that come for you?
Well, it's either sounds stupid or cocky, but I never saw myself not being in baseball. And as I got further and further into the game, I realized that not only did I enjoy playing and competing, I also enjoyed coaching. So it sounds like it was well planned out, but it just kind of happened. Generically, that playing led to coaching in the off season, coaching in the off season when I got released as a player led to coaching year round, and that's where we are right now.
Oh, also going back to your playing days a little bit, what was it like to throw a bullpen next to Tom Seaver at USC?
Well, it was pretty intimidating. Now, Jackson knows this story, and I like to share it just so it gives kids perspective. I had a really good record in high school. I won a lot of games in high school. And I was drafted by
How
the Cubs,
many games?
84. And this is obviously school ball and summer ball. I didn't lose very often. I was 84 and 2, and obviously thought that I was PFG, pretty friggin' good. So I was drafted by the Cubs. They didn't offer me a lot of money, and I had a scholarship offer to play at, USC for the Trojans. So I accepted that, went down, and my first legitimate bullpen in college, I'm throwing, and there's this guy next to me who I'd heard about but never seen in person. And I'm going, oh, and my fastball is getting up there. And this guy next to me is going, pow, pow. And Coach Dado, the head coach at USC at that time, walks up behind me, puts his hand on my shoulder, and said, "Tommy House, what do you think of young Tom Seaver?" And I looked Coach Dado in the face and I said, "Skipper, if you need me to do that, you got the wrong left-hander." And then he said something that I use to this day. He said, No. I don't need you to be Tom Seaver. I need you to be the best Tom House you can be." And this lesson, we actually used it today. We're not asking kids to compete for a job with someone else. They're competing for a job with their own best self. And that gives perspective, takes a whole lot of pressure on process and preparation. And that's one of the lessons that both Jackson and I have learned working with each other and with working kids that with mustard and like today where they're just where there were eight pitchers and like 10 quarterbacks today.
The question for you, I'm interested in. Do you feel like you can still compete as a coach?
Oh yeah, definitely. Competition is if you're passionate about what you do, no matter what field you're in, competition is part of that passion. You don't like to do it in a vacuum, and you don't want everything to be easy. You want to be challenged a little bit. And obviously as a coach, you're competing. If your kids do well, that's awesome. And you always want what you're teaching your kids or your athletes to help them be better than their competition. But I'll tell you what, nothing beats actually playing the game. The power of play, when you're fortunate enough to be able to go between the lines with your teammates, and good or bad, enjoy the power of play. I really enjoy coaching, and I always will. But when I dream, I still dream like I'm playing. And the funny thing is, I'm never any better in my dreams than I was as a real person. So I think I was realistic about what my talent actually was.
Well, also talking about playing, and you caught in Henry Aaron's 715th home run. What was that like in that scenario with the Atlanta Braves?
There are bonuses that come with being able to play a particular sport for a long time. And one of the bonuses, it actually boils down to the highlight of my major league career. And that was being in the bullpen in Atlanta and having Henry Aaron hit his 715th home run right at me, which I caught and ran it back in and gave it to him at home plate. That literally is the highlight of my major league career.
You know, people know this, and a lot of people looked up to, you know, Hank Aaron, Henry Aaron. And how would you define him as a person, not just a player, but a person?
On and off the field, he was authentic and what I like to say, quietly competent. He never got overexcited with anger, never got overexcited with success. He showed up every day, Henry being Henry. He was a simple person. He loved hanging out in the clubhouse, playing hearts and spades. I was a low-end guy, 10th man on the 10-man pitching staff with the Braves, and he treated me just like he treated Darrell Evans and Dusty Baker and Ralph Garr. So from that perspective, my smile memories with Henry Aaron were all about a special guy who was authentic on and off the field. And for me, quietly competent at everything he did.
And kind of going into your coaching aspect of it as well, besides playing with some great players you've coached, Randy Johnson, Drew Brees, Tom Brady, my grandfather, to name a few, what did you learn from them that you did not know when you were coaching?
Well, one of the things that people, you know, don't really understand, when you're around excellence, when you're around someone that is really good at what they do, obviously, you put what you think you're good at out in front, but also you learn from them. I think it was Socrates that said he learned more from his pupils than they learned from him. And I can actually say the same thing. I probably have learned more. I've been blessed. I've been in front of Hall of Famers in many sports, football, baseball, tennis, golf. And in those situations, when you're working with the special athlete, you will hear things and learn things from them that help you get better as an instructor. So, you know, you, Jackson, you mentioned I learned a lot from your grandfather, Noel. I'm continuing to learn from Drew Brees and Tom Brady. I learned a lot from Phil Mickelson, Randy Johnson. He's just like a giant version of me. But listening to him and how he thought, even with 100-mile-an-hour fastball, and seeing that they get nervous and they have all the same things that normal people like you and I go through, they just handle it in a much different way on a bigger stage every day.
Who do you think was the most underrated player you either coached or played with?
Underrated? Well, I played what I call players that are quote underrated are players that glue all the pieces together. I think playing with Atlanta, probably one of the most underrated athletes on the team was a guy named Darrell Evans, who I think Darrell was the only infielder to hit 200 home runs in both leagues. And when Darrell was our third baseman with the Braves, he was an average fielder, but he was also part of a hitting group where we had five hitters in the lineup that hit 25 or more home runs. And Darrell put up 25 to 35 home runs for a year for a long time. But because he played with Henry, Rico Cardi was there. There were always hitters who were getting more publicity than he did, but he kind of glued that lineup together.
I think just in general, I mean, we can get into talk about Team Mustard. And for anyone that doesn't know, where did this kind of come from? Idea that, again, you wanted to stay in the game in this form to a more widely available than, I mean, you can reach as many people as on the plane if you don't need. Like, you can reach anyone now. So where did this idea come from?
Well, Alex, that's a great question. And I'd like to say this was another well-thought-out thing. It just kind of happened. It was sort of an epiphany. And I think one day, one of the founders of Mustard, Jason Goldsmith, we were sitting, I was up at USC at the time, where I was doing research and working as their pitching coach. And Jason said, and I quote, "I wonder how many Nolan Ryans go home because they don't access the quality of information and instruction that these kids that are here with us today are getting." And that was the germ of the idea. What would happen if we could access, democratize, I think is a word that we use, if we could democratize for 100 million kids the same information and instruction that our elite athletes are getting, and it scales, you know, get it on a cell phone so that a mom and a dad or a little league coach could give the same quality of information and instruction as the kids that came to our workout today. And that's the basis by which Mustard was founded.
And you kind of touched on this too, but talk about the power of play and how vital that is today, because kids don't really enjoy playing the game after age 14.
Exactly. That sets me up really good, Jackson. In today's sports world, 80% of young boys and girl athletes stop playing by age 14 because it's not fun. They're failing or they're getting hurt. And what that does, it kind of eliminates the power of play for them. The ability of a child to play, where they get life lessons in a situation where they learn affiliation, they learn how to deal with adversity, they learn that outcome is nice, but process is better. They learn empathy. They learn how to, you know, when one of your teammates strikes out with the bases loaded or gives up a home run, you hurt for your teammates just like you hurt for yourself. Those lessons, if you're not able to play in sports, are hard to learn and much more difficult circumstances. So what we're doing is trying to harness the power of play and give these young people a chance to develop their personalities in a situation where they can learn and learn that failure is actually a good thing. You can learn more from your failures than you do your successes. And what we're finding out is if you can have someone play at least through high school, it helps them for the rest of their life, mentally and physically, and they become a fan of sports. So it's a big win from three different directions. Okay.
Now, obviously, the obvious is you kept playing after the age of 14. So how did you, after the age of 14, still make the game fun?
I have fun today. It's never been not fun. I don't know if that makes any sense. I can honestly, and we actually talked about it in our review with the kids today. I have never gone to a ballpark or a stadium on any given day and not laughed at something. And I know there's people out there that might go 2 weeks without a gut laugh. In sports, when you're on a team, someone is always making you laugh. Even when you're getting your butts kicked, there's something funny that goes on every day.
Well, I want to pull up this tweet that you tweeted out, Tom. I thought it would be fitting for the podcast because you tweeted, "Stop asking about the highlight of someone's career. Ask about the most valuable moment of their career." So I think I would have to be fired if I didn't ask you, being so close to this interview, what was the most valuable moment in your career?
I'll tell you what. I gave up. You know what? Nobody's ever asked me that question. So kudos to you. This is going to take about a minute. Have you got a minute for the story?
We have as much time.
Okay, so we're in a pennant race. I'm with the Red Sox at the time, and we're in Yankee Stadium. And again, we're in a pennant race. And Don Zimmer brings me in a ball game to face a guy named Chris Chambliss, who I'd been pitching against since college days and had always got him out. The matchup said it was all in my favor. Well, Don Zimmer said, "Housie, I don't care what you do, don't let him take you deep." And before Don Zimmer's butt hit the bench, the game was over. The first pitch I threw was a hung curveball. Chambliss took it to the upper deck in Yankee Stadium. I can't tell you how bad I felt. I mean, I was crushed. At that time, winning a playoff and being in the first round of the, in the offseason playoffs was worth probably $25,000. So there were a lot of guys on the team that weren't making $25,000. And here I give up a home run and we lose to the in a playoff game with the Yankees. So I'm sitting on the bench, and I don't know if you know what Yankee Stadium is like even today, but when you've done something bad or good in Yankee Stadium, there's usually 20 sports writers waiting in your locker. So I'm sitting on the bench. I do not want to go in the clubhouse. I literally do not want to go in the clubhouse because I know what's waiting for me in there. So the ground crew is finishing up. The stadium crew is finishing up. And then off to my right, here comes the guy, Carl Yastrzemski, who's the captain of the team. And he's got two beers and two Budweisers in his hand. And he sits down next to me and gives me a beer. And he says, "Was it the right pitch?" I said, "Yeah, it was the right pitch." He said, "But it was the wrong location." I said, "Obviously." And he said, "Forget about it. Listen, and listen close." He said, "It's only chips. It's not like losing friends. There's 24 guys in there that have been where you are. Let's get in, take a shower, and get out of here." Now, if it had been anybody but the captain of the team, Carl Yastrzemski, Hall of Famer, MVP, telling me, one of the low-end guys, they understand. That's that empathy. That, for me, was a learning experience in a failing situation when I realized how valuable sports can be with the power of play and the affiliation and the empathy that you have with your teammates. Did that make sense? It's a story where it was an absolute failure. By the way, there's a second part to that. I didn't hear my last name in Boston for the next 2 years. It was not pitching for the Sox. Number 29, Tom Boo. So again, but it didn't define me. And to this day, if it hadn't been for Carl Yastrzemski, I probably would have caved in. I hope that made sense.
That was great. That was absolutely great.
But give us one good story about Nolan and for all the viewers that understand.
Okay, so Jackson has heard me tell stories about his granddad. And I'm surprised to hear that in family outings or whatever, Nolan never talks about himself. If I was Nolan Ryan, I'd talk to anybody who was anywhere that would sit down and listen to me. But one of the things that was really cool about Nolan, when he first joined the Rangers, Bobby Valentine was the manager of the Texas Rangers, and obviously I was the pitching coach. And we had played with or against Nolan our whole lives. And here comes Nolan Ryan. He's now a pitcher on the Texas Ranger pitching staff. What are we going to expect from this legendary superstar? So the first couple outings went really well. And finally, he was struggling a little bit in the third outing. And again, we'd never been through, what are we going to do when he's struggling? So Bobby, I think, is going to find out what Nolan's going to do to me first before he... So Bobby sends me out to find out how Nolan is doing. So I jog out. I get up in front of him. I say, Nolan, how you doing? And I'm going to clean this up a little bit. He said, Tom, I'm doing terrible. But it's way better what you got warm up in that bullpen. Get the hell off my mound. And I said, okay, I got it. So I went and sat next to Bobby. And Bobby said, what did he say? I said, it's probably going to be hard to get him out of the game. So two innings later, Nolan's having another tough inning, and Bobby goes out to take him out of the game. So when Bobby gets out to him, he said, Tex, that'll be it. And Nolan looks Bobby in the face and said, no, it won't, Bob. One of us is leaving this mound, and it ain't going to be me. So Bobby jogs back in, sits down next to me, and he says, I didn't do any better than you did. We're going to have to figure this out. So that's the story about Nolan. I don't think it's repeated very often, but it shows you what when he went to pitch in a ball game, he was going to give you 7+ innings or die trying.
So what ended up happening in that game? Did he stay in there? Or how did he get
about? In the game, we ended up, he got no decision, and he was right. Even at his worst, he was still better than anything we had on the ball. So Nolan wasn't wrong very often. And when he knew he was right, you're not going to change his mind.
Hey, Tom, I got one last question for you. Jackson and I, we just brought it up on the other podcast we did when we were talking about Hunter Green's a pitcher. He threw 101, 102, 103, three consecutive pitches in a row. I asked Jackson, I'm going to ask you the same question. 10 years from now, how fast do you think pitchers can throw?
Well, we know for a fact, I know for a fact personally, that the human arm can throw a 2-ounce baseball 118 miles an hour. We've logged it in. I know that the hardest I've ever seen with a 4-ounce baseball is 115. The hardest I've ever had in front of me where I can actually see it with a 5-ounce baseball was 106. Now we see the left-handed reliever, the Cuban kid with the Yankees. We know he's been around 105 five or six times. If you watch the documentary Fastball, we know that with today's technology that Nolan Ryan probably sat 98, 99 and showed 103, 105 on a regular basis. The medical profession, through testing what they call valgus stress, the tensile strength of the ligaments in the elbow, they seem to think that a consistent 105 to 106 is probably the hardest that anybody's going to throw. I'm going to go out on a limb. I know that the human arm can go 118 miles an hour. And what we're working on right now is how to functionally train the arm to handle workloads at that velocity. So I hope I'm alive to remember what I'm telling you right now. I think within the next 5 years, you're going to see someone in a major league ball game hit 118 miles an hour. But I'm also going to qualify it by this. There'll be some kind of hitter that can turn that cheese around too, just so you know.
Absolutely. But Tom, thanks so much for coming on the podcast today. Where can people learn more about Team Mustard and hear more about what you guys are doing?
Thanks for setting me up on that. And I would strongly suggest anybody listening to this podcast, go to Team Mustard, T-E-A-M, Mustard without the vowels, Team Mustard, just like my hat.com, and just get acquainted with it. And if you're interested, get on the waiting list. We're in beta testing right now, and the early adopters are going to get all the good stuff. I think it's a point in time where the tipping point is arriving. It is a quality app being put out there for a good reason. It's going to reinforce the power of play and hopefully democratize for a whole bunch of families that would never be able to get the quality of information and instruction. Now they can with just a cell phone and shooting what their athlete is doing.